Anyway, a pleasure to be here. I'm Mark Simon of Torreya Partners. I want to thank the organizers. The title of our panel is Data, Data Everywhere. How do we interpret the facts? So I want to lead off with, what are facts? And if we think about Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, I don't know if any of you know of Senator Moynihan, but he actually was from Hell's Kitchen. And Hell's Kitchen actually borders this hotel. But he had a great phrase when he was a United States Senator, and he would always say to people, you are entitled to your own set of opinions, but not facts. So I also want to give a story that's true that I was involved with about 12 years ago as a banker. And I was sitting with the company on a Friday afternoon, and they were discussing their cancer data. And the intent to treat was negative. And the question was, what do you put in the press release on Monday morning? And the question was, well, I guess you do have to disclose that the intention to the ITT data was negative, but what about finding a couple of great subgroups? What about maybe showing all patients treated or randomized or all completers? And we went back and forth, and the general counsel said the following. I'll let you guys think about this. It's not a lie if you don't tell the truth, but if you falsify the facts, that's a problem. So I want to let you think about that as a backdrop, that, again, it's not a lie if you don't tell the truth, but falsifying a fact is a problem. So even the general counsel at this company drew the line that they couldn't falsify. So that, I think, will be a way to start this panel on the obscure, opaque area of cancer clinical data. So I'm going to let each panelist give their name, rank, and serial number, and then I'll have Rob Glassman kick off the presentations. Rob, why don't you just give your quick background?
Rob Glassman, I'm a jack of all trades, master of none. I'm an oncologist and a failed scientist by training. Was at McKinsey for 4 years. Was in private equity at both Merrill Lynch and OrbiMed for a few years, and then spent most of my career in investment banking. I'm a vice chairman at Credit Suisse.
Mark?
I'm Mark Retain. I'm a medical oncologist at the University of Chicago. I've done work both in drug development and diagnostic development, and we have a Center for Personalized Therapeutics. I've also recently founded a startup around our genomic prescribing system, as well as a new foundation on value in cancer care.
And Kapil?
I'm Kapil Dhingra. I'm a medical oncologist by training, academic career through MD Anderson and Memorial Sloan Kettering, then head of Roche Oncology for many years. For the last 8 years, I've been an independent consultant and have the privilege of being on the boards of some really exciting bio-oncology companies that have exited and that others that are about to exit.
Thank you. All right, Rob, why don't we turn to Rob's slides, and Rob will tell us why we should be cynical or skeptical on some of these biotech press releases.
First of all, I want to thank both the people at Define Health, Ed and Jeff, for another wonderful conference. Panelists who I've written with and spoken to and have educated me as well. How do I move slides?
Yep.
Oh, this thing? Where do I sit?
Oh, you can see it right there.
Oh, wow. This is great. Okay, so I've interacted with a lot of different types of people, academics, including thought leaders, major champions and experts within pharmaceutical and biotech companies, other bankers, consultants, research analysts. And I will say, and I'll put myself in the same category, most of us are pretty dumb. Most of what you read in a research report is wrong. It's not well, or not well analyzed, or missing something, or just skin deep. And I think these quotes actually sort of say it all, that that how we are often basically fooled by randomness and don't look at things with deep scrutiny or with a lot, or with a statistical lens. So there's a lot of mistakes that are made, both looking at the science wrong, looking at the data wrong, looking at the commercial and market wrong, putting it out of context, the competitive picture wrong. But a lot of what you see is what Mark sort of pointed to, is getting a lot of data and somehow finding something positive out of it, which is why I actually why I created that cartoon. So what are some of the common mistakes that are made? Well, first of all, believe it or not, companies kind of lie or mislead. I mean, it's kind of shocking. As a matter of fact, as an former investor, I would play a detective game where I would try to find where they were lying or not showing me something. And then if everything fit out, I would say that's pretty good, even if it was not impressive. So just like Mark says, it was transparent. Typically they'll show you this great curve that looks like this with P less than 0.01, and I'll say, so is that the intent to true? What was the trial design again? This is per protocol at the highest dose for patients who were born in April, and only took the drug in the morning. I said, that's good.
That could be a pattern.
That's a pattern. That's an important pattern. I mean,
that was absolutely prospectively designed.
So on the top left is a British Medical Journal article that looked at complete response letters from the FDA and what the press releases were. And guess what? Only 14% were accurate. 86% had material deficits or were actually false. The top right, which Mark will go into, and I actually agree, is the fact that single-arm trials are inherently overestimate a drug's effect. This is a study from Zhang that was published in JCO in 2005 that looked at phase two single-arm trials versus phase three randomized control trials with the same chemotherapeutic agent in smaller numbers, and the response rates and the and also other markers, including survival, were much higher in the phase two study. The most common thing, though, we've seen is retrospective data dredging, or as I would say, torture the data enough and it will confess. And I've spoken at this before. This is from JCO, May of 2015. And this is actually a problem, I think, with many. This is actually at the academic level, and including publications like JCO. There's 221 randomized studies that were published in JCO, encompassing about 185,000 patients. 85% of them report a subgroup analysis, but only 8% could you determine the number of subgroups. So it would be nice if when somebody said, I did a subgroup analysis, they said, well, how many queries did you make? Because if you query enough, you can find something. And as an example of this, in 2000, I'm not going to tell you the company's name, but in the mid part of the decade, a company said, Rob, we've completed our data, our trial, our phase two randomized trial. And it was, and I said, well, what was the intent to treat? It was completely negative. I said, that's too bad, but you did the right trial. Oh, no. We did this biomarker in there. The biomarker, p-value, amazing. Drug did great. P-value, 0.02. I said, how many biomarkers and other things did you look at? A lot. But this one works. So I said, query this data set by the first letter of the patient's last name in the trial, if you could. Come back 3 months later. He calls me a genius. You can't make this stuff up. calls me a genius, and I said, I just was trying to illustrate something to you. No, we got it. C's, H's, and W's. It was Asian. It was an Asian population. 40% of the biomarkers are Asian, so we think there's something there. And we're going to pursue an Asian biomarker study. So anyway, that didn't happen. But that is exactly, people are really misled by data dredging, and it's a problem. So that being said, how do you decide and how do you interpret a randomized study versus statistical what I call statistical process control? Because these are really, a single arm study is, it's like a quality improvement study. That's how it's been veered. How have things changed? Has the quality of data improved over time? So include that as a single-arm study. But basically, randomized studies, if well-designed and blinded and without biases and with a representative population of patients, are obviously will give you better information than a single-arm study. But they have flawed. You have no knowledge from prior trials. The ease of recruitment is much harder. There's ethical issues when we know placebo doesn't work. It costs more money. The speed of the answer is years versus potentially one patient. So I think what Brian Jones talked about last year. And there's biases. And actually the biases that come out of poorly communicated randomized studies are far worse than the biases in single-arm studies. They have ascertainment bias if it's open label, lack of centralized review. There's data dredging, we showed. There's missing data. There's wrong controls. There's exploratory analyses. The issues, of course, with single-arm studies are basically selection and investigator biases, so you need to raise the bar there. The question is, most single-arm studies are not going to give you enough information. But could they give you information that at least says something? Mark will say no coming up here, but I think there are times that it could. And which is the question. This is an article I've been writing now for 9 years. So if you want to Mark knows that because we're supposed to write it together at ASCO. And then it keeps on like making me do more work on it, and it's hard, I ain't a good writer. So actually, I have a good medical writer in the background there who's Grace Kim, who's actually said she'd help me write it. One is people say, well, just ask the thought leaders. Well, I've asked thought leaders a lot, and it's generally sensitive. If they say this is nothing new, it's right, but if it's not really specific, they generally will get too excited about things. Prognostic criteria, well, you could actually say, let's take that same group of patients and what would the data be if they were in the best prognostic group? Motor score in renal carcinoma or whatever, the best group, how would they do? The third one is, and this is only works if A, the effect size is extremely large, B, there is very few confounding factors, C, we know some information about the drug ahead of time, and four, speed of answer and cost are important considerations. Then like for rabies or Gleevec or things like that, you would see what's called a statistical process control, which basically looks at the variability, how much over the upper limit of normal, and looks at if and it would be repeated. You'd have to repeat these things over and over again. So you'd say you had 20 patients. We got this 70% responses in third line gastric, and we repeat it again and again versus historic controls. The one I have found to be very useful, and this is a trick that you should all write down, not show anybody outside this room, so you know the answer. You now know. You are now part of what's the inner cabal. Is I actually look for other small phase two trials. And I compare it. And I'm mostly doing this to rule out, not to rule in, but to rule out stuff that's not interesting. So a lot of times companies will go to me and they'll say, oh, we got this great data versus the historic controls. And I just say, well, I found three phase two trials that were done by drugs that eventually failed that had similar data. But I remember when I was a banker for Cougar, which had abiraterone, and Cougar had phase two data, and J&J, by the way, had no clue, about the drug at the time, and I introduced it to them. Shows you how good business development teams are, at times, but they, to give them credit, they actually listened to what I had to say, and they responded very well. So, I showed them every phase two trial I can find in castration resistant in small phase prostate cancer. I just showed you some examples here: ketoconazole, sacroplatin. There was a whole bunch of others, and I compared it with abiraterone. And if you looked at it, including those with prior, these were just like right in front of you.
only time I ever saw a RECIST response was with abiraterone in these patients, and that was with prior taxanes. And the PSA response were much higher than everything I've ever seen. Now, does that prove the point? No, they had to go into phase three and they proved the survival benefit. But it made it interesting. And most of the time, this sort of analysis will prove you to be, to prove that things are actually not that as interesting and need to be, have a randomized trial. So, yes, I'm never wrong, except when Koppel tells me I'm wrong, because he's right. And by the way, and I've had discussions with people on here who actually, and these are just some of the nuances. There's a lot of data nuance. It's very hard to really interpret data carefully. And there's something, and I've been educated by people on this panel and elsewhere, to say, oh, I hadn't thought of that. You know, there's sometimes people will show you a PFS and say, look, our PFS is so great. I said, how's the hazard ratio? Oh, it's the same. Well, that's what's important is the hazard ratio, not the PFS. So those are types of things that you have to, that you don't realize. Thank you very much.
Okay, Mark, the floor is yours.
Good. While we're putting up my slides, I want you to imagine I'm the CEO of a company called Magic Coin, okay? And I'm the purveyor of a magic coin that always comes up heads, and you never know when that would be useful. Like you might want to make a bet with somebody, and I'm gonna prove it to you. I'm gonna flip the coin 10 times in a row. It's always gonna come up heads, and you're gonna watch me do it, and you say, "Wow, it's really a magic coin." So if you watch me do it 10 times in a row, and I've told you ahead of time I'm gonna do it 10 times in a row, do you believe I can repeat that? And you're going to feel pretty confident about that. Now, let's think of a different scenario. Let's imagine there's 1,000 people in this room. And I say, everybody take a coin out of their pocket, and everybody flip it 10 times in a row, and raise your hand if you came up all heads. Okay? Well, there's a good chance somebody out of 1,000 people will be able to do that. I mean, what's the chance of 10 heads in a row? It's 1 in 1,024. But will that person be able to do it again? No way. So it's not the p-value that matters. You really have to think of the context in which that p-value was generated. So I thought I would share with you my thoughts on, you're looking at a positive phase 2 trial. And you want to know, well, what's the probability of phase 3 success? So I would refer you to this paper, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. Okay? It's by John Ioannidis. I believe he's even on the list of individuals being considered for NIH director. He's an epidemiologist at Stanford. And this is probably his most famous paper. And it basically is a mathematical proof of why most published research findings are false. So it really shouldn't surprise us that when somebody tells you that they have a positive phase 2 trial, that the phase 3 trial is not successful. So, and I'll just take you through a little bit of this, and I would encourage you to read the paper. And so he goes through, and he makes the point that the probability of a true positive depends on a number of factors. So you have to go to the study that was positive, and the first thing you have to ask is, well, what was the power of that study? What was the probability of getting a false negative result? Okay, because that's really important. If a study has low power, well, then most of your positives are a true positive is going to be relatively infrequent. What was the type 1 error, the probability of a false positive of the prior study? What would you consider to be the pre-study probability of success? In other words, before you did the study, you're looking at the data. How likely is it that study is going to be positive? And then what's the bias of the study itself? Are there things fishy about the analysis, protocol was changed, et cetera? And he basically goes through and tells you that the best case scenario is about 85% truth. You have a really good randomized controlled trial, well-powered, well-conducted. There's about an 85% chance that that's a true finding. So, and you and the way he does this is you estimate the base case, and the base case is basically power divided by the power plus the type 1 error. And so with a typical 80% power, type 1 error 0.05, your base case is 94%. And, you know, with a underpowered study, and again, we see far worse in oncology, 60% power, type 1 error of 20%, 75%. So this is a base case, but really you have to then start discounting from the base case. And there's you can between this paper and some other work in the literature, you could begin to come up with estimates of how much to discount. So the first thing you can do is discount for bias. And there's always going to be some bias, but some studies are fishier than others. And again, you know, when you start seeing what do you know about the sponsor, what do you see in the flexibility of the phase two trial, you're going to discount 10 to 40% based on bias. And so even starting at your 95%, you're going to have to discount 10%, which is how he gets to the 85% truth. But then there's other things unique to oncology. For example, historical controls. Rob alluded to that. There's a nice paper that proved, for example, that you inflate your type 1 error by at least 2 and maybe 4-fold when you use historical controls. And that's if you actually are able to demonstrate that something is significantly better than a pre-specified historical control. In many cases, you see trial designs where people say, well, I rejected my null hypothesis, therefore my alternative hypothesis is true, which, of course, is not true. And if you see that kind of positive trial, you can discount it 100%. Then we have subset analyses. Well, anytime you see subset analyses, you know there were at least 3 analyses. There was the overall analysis and then 2 subsets. So by definition, you should discount that 67% at least. And then probably the most important is what I refer to is before you saw the data, you just heard there's, you know, some new drug and it's being added to this backbone, it's being compared to, you know, the control. And you look at it and you go, what do I think? Am I skeptical? Am I a believer? If you go, 20% chance it would work. Well, you should be discounting. You should not be that surprised when you see a positive result. In other words, you should discount your skepticism. Discount for that skepticism by about 75%. So at the end of the day, just because a phase two trial is positive, even with the p-value 0.001. Now remember, how many oncology drugs do we have in development? Maybe about 1,000. So imagine they're all up there, all these companies are trying to get their $1 billion or whatever for being successful in phase two. And they're not just running one phase two trial. When I just looked today, there's about 1,800 industry-sponsored phase two trials right now. It should not be surprising that one or more of those is going to end up with a p-value of 0.001. That's just the lottery winner in the group. It's not the real winner. So if you go back to the paper from Ioannidis, there is a table that he constructs in there, which is the positive predictive value of research findings for various combinations of power, ratio of true to not true relationships, which sort of goes to the skepticism, and then bias, which goes to sort of the finagling with the study. And you see his best case scenarios is the top line, an adequately powered randomized controlled trial with little bias and 1-to-1 pre-study odds, positive predictive value of 85%. And then we go down to what we could call Oncoland, underpowered, sometimes well-performed, sometimes poorly performed, and, you know, positive predictive value 17 to 23%, and that might even be generous for some of the studies that we see, where you might be far more skeptical than is depicted here, and there may be even poor conduct and poor statistical design. So again, do not be overwhelmed by a p-value. I think the most important thing to look at is look at the drug, look at the biology, look at the pharmacology, look at the preclinical studies, and, of course, look at the sponsor. That's all I have.
Okay, Kapil.
Thanks, Mark. So the two previous presentations set the stage for my brief remarks. So what I would talk about a little bit about is, can we go back one slide, please? Thank you. So I picked this title purposely because what I want to do is focus on some real-world examples of data. I'm going to only take three examples and try to illustrate certain points which I believe are relevant to how we look at the data when they come out, and I'm going to pick actual academically presented data at ASCO from well-conducted industry-sponsored trials. But at the same time, there is also a reality we face. I think Mark has outlined for you all the issues we deal with in terms of generating confidence of the likelihood of predicting phase 3 success. The reality is, most of the time, we will not have big randomized phase 2 database. Historical databases are inaccurate. Standards in oncology are changing very, very fast. And those of us in the industry, we have to make a real-time decision. There's no magic to it. There's no right or wrong. It's about increasing the probability of success. And I believe it's largely, we cannot predict what's going to work. But I think we can increase the odds of predicting what's not working. And that's the sum total of the game we play as oncology drug developers. So I'll show you some real examples, and I'll give you the answer right now. Don't believe your lying eyes. Believe me. So now that the suspense is gone, the fallacy of best response. Best response curves, you've seen this all the time, so-called waterfall plot. These are a creation of last 15 years. Largely arose because too many of our targeted drugs weren't producing the classical partial responses that lasted certain length of time. So these creative graphs were created. Just to be clear, the data from rosnilimab, but this has nothing to do with the controversy last about disclosure. That's a separate issue. This is actually the actual data that have been in public domain presented at ASCO. And rosnilimab, which is an EGFR T790 targeted drug, you can see this is as beautiful a waterfall plot as you want to see. The key here is best response. Best response, for those of you who don't do oncology every day, is the greatest tumor shrinkage any time during the time that the patient is on the trial. Now, what this doesn't account for the fact is a couple of things. One is that if a patient progressed before they ever got to the first CT scan while they were on the drug, they're never on this graph. Because you actually don't know how much the tumor increased, so the left side of this graph always misses a few patients. Depending on the trial, it could be few or a lot of patients. Second thing, if you did a CT scan on a patient now and repeated a CT scan on the same patient 30 minutes later, you will have about a 15% or maybe a little bit larger difference in measurement of their tumors. That's just the nature of the technique we use. And obviously, this type of plot doesn't account for that. In this case, specifically what happened was this graph, if you add up the numbers, the best response, as defined as objective best response, was approximately 60%. But when the criteria of objective response was applied, which only adds one other dimension to it, which is that the tumor shrinkage of 30% unidimensional decrease in tumor size should have persisted for at least 4 weeks. I think all of us would agree less than 4 weeks, tumor shrinkage is not meaningful. But when you added the criteria of 4 weeks, the response rate went from about 60% to 30%. I use this example because one of the more striking examples of the misuse of best response, if you will, in terms of understanding of the data. But this is something everyone does. It is not one company, not one drug. Every one of us does it, academia, industry, because it's a way that the data look a whole lot prettier than they would if you didn't actually use the best response criteria. So this is second example used from a phase 3 trial. The drug is fulvestrant, which is a SERD, selective estrogen receptor degrader, or an anti-estrogen simplistically. The drug was approved at a dose of 250 milligrams. And wasn't a great market uptake. It became clear along the way that the pharmacology of the drug suggested that the right dose was probably 500 rather than 250. So the drug was tested in a randomized trial comparing 250 and 500 doses. And shown on the left is the progression-free survival, and shown on the right is the overall survival. So as you can see on the left, depending on where you draw the line, typically we look at medians. One of the fallacies in looking at medians is that Kaplan-Meier curves are not designed ideally, in an idyllic way, in that the real data in life turn differently, in that if you draw a horizontal line here, let's see, I don't know if I have a pointer. I don't have a pointer, never mind. So if you, depending on where you, if you draw the 50th percentile line, you may have zero difference or you may have 3 months difference. And most of the time, oncologists and sometimes even regulators are so hung up on median differences in PFS and overall survival, and median can be completely misleading. There are numerous examples from actual registration trial of the so-called kissing Kaplan-Meier curves, where the Kaplan-Meier curves just happen to come together at the median, or balloon Kaplan-Meier curves, where the Kaplan-Meier curves just happen to be separated widely at the median and come together before and after. So one has to look at the totality of the data. And in this case, when they looked at the median, they claimed, even though response rates were identical, the median PFS was 5.5 versus 6.5, but if you drew the line 2 percentile above, it will be 2 months difference. If you draw the line 2% below, it could be 3 months difference. And overall survival benefit of 3 months was claimed. As you can see, if you draw a line right at 50th percentile, which will be 0.5 on the y-axis, that will give you about a 3 month survival benefit. But actually, if you look at the Kaplan-Meier curve, there is no separation really. The curves cross several times along the way and then come together again right at 42nd percentile. So you might say, well, that's okay, no big deal. At least as long as the safety profile of the two dose levels is similar, that should be okay. Yes, that would be okay. So the safety profile of the two dose levels were claimed to be similar, except if you think about how the drug is given. It's a large bowl, long needle, 5 ml injection, one in each buttock if you need 500 milligram over 1 to 2 minutes. So you decide if that's the same safety profile or not. I'll use one more example of hidden bias. It's a very interesting example, actually. And I'm not second-guessing any company or drug or group of people after the fact. These were facts that became too light as the studies were being done. So this is CRS-207. This was a vaccine for pancreatic cancer, listeria vaccine targeting mesothelin. On the left is a phase 2 trial presented at ASCO, reputed investigator. And the actual therapeutic vaccine was CRS-207, but they did it on the backbone of a GVAX vaccine. GVAX had been tested before, so it was an open-label phase 2 trial. Control arm was GVAX alone, and treatment arm was GVAX plus 207. About 90-patient study, 2-to-1 randomization for the treatment arm. Everything looks great. Curves separate early, continue to separate, and this is the type of thing you might take to say, wow, that's great. This is the kind of phase 2 you would like to see. And the data were, quote-unquote, statistically significant for overall survival, argued as perhaps one of the best survival benefits ever in pancreatic cancer. Except there is a slight problem. The problem is if you look at the text below, I put in the design. Arm A was a low-dose Cytoxan with GVAX vaccine for 2 doses, followed by CRS-207. And arm B was Cytoxan, low-dose Cytoxan with GVAX for 6 doses. The schedule was week 1 and week 4 GVAX, and then remaining time every 4 weeks or so, patients got GVAX in arm B and CRS-207 in the arm A. So if you just think about it, and sort of it didn't quite come out even when the data were presented at ASCO, if you believe you need at least 2 doses of the vaccine, CRS-207, for it to have any effect, essentially you are at week 10 before the treatment in the two arms has actually changed. Because for the first 6 weeks, patients in both arms are getting exactly the same treatment, which is the GVAX vaccine. And as you can see, the curves have already started to separate by 6 weeks when you look at on the left curve. And by the time you get to 10th week, the curves are already far apart, telling you that this is a great example where something has happened at baseline, whether it's prognostic factor imbalance or something else, that even though a phase two randomized trial has been done, where curves separated early and kept separating more, the reality is that people missed the point that for such 6 weeks, people were getting exactly the same treatment, and you needed another 6 weeks for the vaccine to give a response. Therefore, these results had to be spurious. The only other explanation you can come up with is that the GVAX vaccine was actually harming patients. Now, that's not out of question, by the way. GVAX vaccine had failed a trial before. And if you look at the blue line there, that curve drops steadily, and the GVAX curve starts dropping right after phase two. So with all the caveats Mark outlined about not over-interpreting small number of patients, there is a lot of red flags here that predicted for eventual failure of phase three. So I'll stop here. I just want to highlight some of these examples as a way to illustrate that we have to make our decisions early, but usually we can learn a lot more information from relatively limited data sets that are available to it. And I'll echo what Mark said. Look at the total biology of the drug, pharmacology of the drug, because in this day and era of targeted therapies, a few patients can provide us a lot of information that justifies a huge investment in phase three versus not, and not some blindly following some old paradigms. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Okay, we've heard all the negatives about how data is presented, but I want to ask the panel, when would a single-center trial, small number of patients, actually generate data that you would say is meaningful? What would be the circumstances where we know every checkbox will be negative, but when would you look at a small quantity of data at one center and say, this is meaningful, this is not just, you know, randomization or noise?
Well, I mean, you know, when there's a meaningful clinical benefit and you can clearly ascribe it to the investigational drug. So the problem is anything that's got, you know, multiple drugs in it, by definition, you can't clearly ascribe it. So, but, you know, if you have a patient with a refractory disease and you're treating with an investigational drug that we'll call a wonder drug, and you know, you see reproducible evidence of regressions that you know, lasts more than two CT scans, that's meaningful.
Rob, your views on when you think that would be meaningful?
Well, a little bit like what I wrote before, but A, you have to trust, assuming you trust the center and the investigators, where something along the lines like, we've never seen this before. I mean, and there is some supportive small study data to support that point.
And who would have to read the scans? Let's say, again, it was in a highly refractory population. How would you ensure that the scans, there's no bias on them?
Prefer, of course, that it not be read by the investigator. So essentially reviewed and somehow blinded.
Kapil, anything to add to?
No, only thing I'll add is I think credibility of investigator, and I really, when you have that limited a data set, I get down to individual patient level. And one thing I would add is looking at patients' history before they got on the trial of your drug, the so-called mirror plot type of thing. Lots of caveats to it, but at least you get a feel for patient's natural history of the disease. And then if you're seeing significant tumor shrinkage, for example, as a monotherapy, that becomes interesting.
That's a very important point. I should have said that. Looking at the patient level, a lot of times when you go there, you really find out things were a little screwy. There's an example. For example, I saw an example of a patient of a study in AML. Where the company said they had these great responses, but it was really just about 10 patients. So we have one or two, quote, CRs. It meant something. The problem was the blast count prior to treatment was like 8% in one and 11% in the other. So when they got the drug, it went down to 5%, which is often within variability. So it was really, and that was viewed as a CR. So to Kapil's point, when you look at the patients and say they really didn't have much tumor burden, oh, by the way, you surgically removed it and you caused that, and you're calling that a CR, you find a lot of flaws in what they're doing. So I think that's an important point.
And what about a single arm trial? When would a single arm trial, no comparator, be meaningful, or what would be the way to design that where you can say it's clinically relevant?
Well, I think it depends on what the question you want the answer to. I mean, if you're trying to figure out, is it better than something else that works, it's almost never useful. If it's this is a novel target, it's not been studied before, and then you're demonstrating proof of concept. So I think it just depends on the question.
Rob, your views on
both? Well, I think it's that last slide I had. I think, you know, if you go through the thing where, you can say that people will say this data is you have to raise the bar ahead of time. As a matter of fact, I would encourage companies that when they're doing a single-arm study, say, what would be dramatic? What would be, like, this is really important? And they often don't do that. They often get the data and say, and then try to figure out ways to prove that it's dramatic afterwards. So if I've shown, you know, and this is not common, that every small study done has not approached the responses, the PFS, or the survival of this study, and the patients are actually pretty, you know, balanced or even worse from a prognostic standpoint, I think that's meaningful. There are times where it is meaningful. Gleevec was clearly meaningful. I would say I saw Bruvica after 40 patients at ASH in 2009. Oral drug mechanism, to the Bayesian point of view, looked pretty strong. It made a lot of sense. There's a human homologue for BTK, and they got about 40% responses as a single agent in refractory and in a mixture of patients, actually. So I said that's pretty good for an oral single monotherapy drug when I compared it. We invested at OrbiMed at the time. A year and a half later is when the stock went up. It took a while to get there. But that was, to me, something that was intriguing, at least. So I actually think more often than not, doing these analyses on and putting things in context actually shows you that drugs are not that good. And when actually the context shows that they look better than anything ever seen, then it says, well, let's move on to phase three.
Well, you know, just to push back a bit, let's just say hypothetically Rob shows me a data set, and he and I agree that there is a dramatic effect. But then the next thing is, well, how do you know you got the dose right? Maybe you're too high on the dose. And so you're going to end up having to, with your dramatic drug, you're going to then end up going to do some sort of randomized dose-ranging trial because you certainly don't want to be selling your $50,000 a month dramatically effective drug at five times the dose that will get you the same effect. So I think that, again, if you really think you have a dramatic drug, then you want to be doing dose ranging as early as possible. And, of course, if you see a relationship between dose and efficacy, that also tells you that your drug is effective as well.
Kapil, what's your view on a single-arm trial? When do you think that's reliable, or when can you actually say this is well-designed and it's given us important information?
I think it depends on the question you're trying to ask. Are you working with the expectation of success or expectation of failure? A single-arm trial can be good if you're basically just trying to kill a drug, treat a few patients. If I don't see dramatic efficacy, kill it, because you haven't. And by the way, in our industry, there's a big need for that. There's a reason why there are 1,200 open INDs at the FDA, because half of the drug, you and I sit down in 5 minutes and just sort of kill half of them. So that's one. Where I think the single-arm trial are useful are if you have a relatively clear understanding of the target, you have a relatively clear understanding of the pharmacology of the drug, and you have an expectation of tumor shrinkage. That's when it can be useful. Outside of that, it's becoming increasingly difficult. And I will second Mark's point, actually, on the dose ranging, because, and I'll actually pick up on the Gleevec example there, because, you know, life in chemotherapy era was very easy. You just go to MTD, and then you never had to do dose ranging. And that's how most of the current generation of oncology drug developers learned how to do oncology. And frankly, most of us, with exception of people like Mark, are quite terrible at finding the right dose. Gleevec is a very good example. Here's a drug that checked all the boxes. Truly targeted drug, driver oncogenic mutation, selective drug. You had phase one study, safety was great, efficacy started seeing very early, and a dose above 300, 33 out of 36 people responded, if my memory is correct, right? You can't get any better than that, right? And you had the ultimate biomarker, which was clinical efficacy as shown by complete response. You would think everything is done, right? Guess what? The drug goes to market, randomized trial, 400 versus 800 dose, molecular CR rate is double with the 800 milligram dose. So even with a drug that was as clean, as simple as Gleevec, you could conceivably argue now that everybody cares about molecular CR that actually we got the dose wrong.
That's right. What's the Mark's point?
So Kapil used the word shrinkage. That's a famous word from Jerry Seinfeld. But when people mention oncology companies say we saw shrinkage, what does that mean?
No, I think it means an objective decrease in size of tumor. I know you want to go to immuno-oncology here, so let's leave sort of, immuno-oncology also, I've been very quiet all day listening to all the immuno-oncologists. Now that they're gone, we can really talk about what immuno-oncology is.
That's our next part, yep.
Yeah, so Axel Huss is no longer in the room, so we can be frank. In this case, single-arm trial, by and large, I mean more traditional ideas of tumor shrinkage. I don't care. I don't think 29% is that different than 31%. But we're talking meaningful tumor shrinkage and increasingly the durability of shrinkage, which is, I think, actually more crucial than the degree of shrinkage.
So let's shift gears to the IO area. And we've got that immune-related response criteria. That's opening up a whole new can of worms in terms of activity and press releases that can be, as we said, misinterpreted, not totally transparent. Talk a little bit about that definition that's being used and how much leeway do companies have to potentially obfuscate or be, let's say, opaque on the reality.
You know, Bill did a very nice talk right there about how the topology of Kaplan-Meier curves is meaningful. It's actually worthy of an article. And Mark alluded to an issue with IO drugs is that it ended up being that the tail was what's important. So even if there's no responses, you had a 25% of patients had basically very durable remissions. So is there anything that could predict it before? And people have come up with immune response criteria. One thing I never understood, though, was whether or not CRs was still a pretty good surrogate. It was discounted because there's some pseudo remissions or pseudo progressions and this and that. But I still think that the better drugs are still getting some CRs. That being said, it is, and I'm not an IO expert. But much of the literature have been looking for these biomarkers and diagnostic criteria to predict that tail, because that's how IO drugs do. You know, it's interesting with IO because we were so wrong on this for years. If I was a fellow in the 90s, and I thought you should only be studying vaccines and other sort of immunomodulators on patients who had minimally residual disease and had strong protoplasm. Now I'm told that only, metastatic and probably just melanoma and renal cell, now metastatic lung cancer, and by the way, it's maybe better second line than first line, more epitopes, and better older than younger, more epitopes and sicker. I mean, I never would have ever envisioned, that to be the case. So sometimes, it does, we're also drowned in data that's positive, but we just don't see it because we're looking through the wrong lens. And one of the issues is when is important? How do we recognize good stuff and not reduce that? That's we can easily recognize bad stuff. How do we recognize good stuff?
So Kapil, your view on how the whole IO endpoint area further complicates data interpretation?
I think it complicates. I think some of the complexity is temporary. Don't forget, the whole IO immune response criteria really originated because of CTLA-4. Because CTLA-4 had a lot more pseudoprogressors, response rates were low, and that led to evolution. I think they have helped move the field forward. Maybe one way I try to sort of understand, I make distinction between issues related to pseudoprogression versus issues related to mixed response. Mm. I think pseudoprogression is a very specific entity, and increasingly it's becoming clear, actually, if the tumor is becoming larger but your patient is feeling better, it's more likely to be pseudoprogression.
Yeah.
And actually, with PD-1, you see pseudoprogression far less often than you saw with CTLA-4. And I think as we move to combination therapies, this is simply a matter of getting to a certain point other than transient infiltration of infiltrating cells. We probably won't see so much pseudoprogression. Mixed response, I think, is a much more interesting problem and is actually a problem that we're going to face more and more in oncology. Because historically, I think with chemotherapy, we didn't see it so much because the nature of mechanism of action kills everything inside sort of thing. But now we are really starting to tackle the true heterogeneity of tumor, and somebody in a previous panel made the point. Each patient's cancer is a heterogeneous disease, and I would argue each patient's cancer is many unique diseases at initial diagnosis and evolves to many other unique diseases during its natural history. So the more targeted we become with our therapies, including immuno-oncology therapies, the more we are likely to see that some lesions might be shrinking while others are progressing, and our notions of these lines of therapy we have had, first line, second line, may disappear. You're starting to see the paradigms emerge, for example, with EGFR mutation, where T790 can coexist with the other mutation. So it's conceivable a patient with an EGFR mutation gets a first-generation TKI when they progress at T790, but if the original clone is still there, maybe you just add the T790 drug rather than the other. So I think this is the area that I would watch for, and I think immune response criteria in part start to tackle it by taking the total tumor burden into account rather than just if one lesion progresses, somehow you're a progressor.
Mark, any of your perspectives on the IO picture further muddying the waters?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is that it seems that the vast majority of trials are, you know, a checkpoint inhibitor plus something else. And I have no idea how those data get interpreted in a single-arm context. Mm-hmm. And yet the vast majority of trials we're seeing are single-arm trials, at least, and I think that's exactly the situation where you need a randomized trial to have any clue as to whether the investigational drug is adding anything.
Mark, just to add, I think it's a very interesting point because I've been in some discussion with several biotech with the first two PD-1 companies, and it's interesting. They're absolutely insistent they don't want to do randomized trials. Their logic is very simple. We got 500 things to come. 500 is too much. Let's say 50 or 100 things to combine with. We don't have the time or resource to randomize. We'll do single-arm trial, and because all we are interested in are the home runs. So we are doing this combination trial, whatever the numbers are up to now, 400 or 1,100, I forget. But everybody is just looking for home run, and I think there's a rude awakening at the other end of it in the next 12 to 24 months when vast majority of those trials either fail or are uninterpretable.
Now, Jim Allison likes to say that with ipilimumab, stable disease turned out to have a clinical benefit. 10 years ago, we would say stable disease is failure. Or disappointing. But how would you, in terms of IO, let's say redefining things going forward?
I wouldn't have said stable disease was failure 10 years ago. I mean, I did the...
But it wouldn't get you... You wouldn't get FDA approved on stable disease.
No, we did the trial of sorafenib in kidney cancer. That was actually the first use of the waterfall plot, by the way. But we didn't use best response. We used it at a landmark time. And stable disease was perfectly fine. And... We had randomized data to tell us that it was from the drug and not just the selecting really good patients. And you're right, stable disease in the absence of a control group is I don't know how to interpret it.
Actually, Mark, I would sort of push back on the notion that stable disease is a recent phenomenon. The first use of stable disease in oncology actually goes to hormonal therapy of breast cancer. Late 80s, early 90s, John Robertson from Nottingham actually showed that with hormonal therapy of breast cancer, 6-month stable disease had the exact same connotation, prognosis, survival as PR. Because receptor-positive breast cancer was bone-dominant disease, you often didn't have measurable disease, and that led to the notion of clinical benefit rate, which was CRPR plus stable disease 6 months, and that served us very well for approval of a number of hormonal therapy drugs. But as always, as industry, We keep trying to push it further and further. Then clinical benefit rate became, instead of 6 months stable disease, 4 months stable disease. Then it became 2 months stable disease. And now it's the first CT scan assessment, which is at 4 to 6 weeks. And companies are claiming 89% clinical benefit rate in pancreatic cancer for drugs that fail in phase three.
It's really bad when somebody calls that clinical benefit. That's, I mean, at least we could come up with a better name for that, you know, early non-progression or something. But, you know, to say that's a benefit, it's the only beneficiary is the sponsor if they find a greater fool.
Now, companies sometimes announce that, well, this trial had a crossover design or we had to censor some data. Talk to us about the pitfalls of when we see that. What is that? What can that potentially mean on the negative side?
On the negative.
Or I'm just saying, companies will report data and they say, well, we had to censor this part of the data, or we have a crossover design and here's what the data showed, and the crossover muddied the. Just trying to give the, you know, our friends some lessons about when we see these words, what should people look for?
I mean, crossover designs are great for the purpose of the patient, okay? And that's the reason to do a crossover design. It diminishes the validity of the knowledge. But if you can design a trial so that you have an early look at the data and then cross everybody over after that. And so, I mean, there's pretty good evidence that if you, you know, have a solid tumor and you were to do like an 8-week endpoint, and I'm not talking about IO here, but a non-IO drug, an 8-week endpoint that you could compare change in tumor size at 8 weeks as your primary endpoint, that's a pretty good endpoint, for example, in non-small cell lung cancer in the pre-IO era, and the FDA published that analysis. And then you could cross everybody over after 8 weeks. You were not going to learn that much after 8 weeks. Of course, the patients are going to be told, well, everybody's going to get on, you know, what we believe might be the best, greatest and best regimen after 8 weeks, and you're going to maximize your knowledge during the first 8 weeks. You're going to maximize your data collection during the first 8 weeks. It's not that expensive a trial, and yet you have a control arm.
Rob, your views, when is this ripe for manipulation or for misinterpretation?
Missing data is a big issue, and when you see that, and there's plenty of articles. There's one in JAMA recently. There's several. If you just Google it, it depends on how they deal with the missing data and how great the missing data is. When you start seeing, 15% or less missing data, that's, you know, you could, and it's dealt with conservatively, it's probably okay. If you start dealing with 30-40% missing data, you have to sort of ask a lot of questions. And 15% or less, did they do an LOCF? Did they follow an imputed analysis? You know, how conservatively was it handled? If it was handled conservatively, then I think that you have a more valid answer. If it's handled less conservatively, then you have to question it, more bias.
Mark, I'll just add, I think the crossover issue is, if you just step back and say, when would crossover cause you to lose survival benefit, and when would it cause you to lose survival benefit altogether? Theoretically, if a drug was 100% equally effective in the first-line setting and second-line setting, it's possible that when you crossover, you lose all survival benefit. The reality is, in real life, even with immuno-oncology drugs, by and large, drugs still work better in the earlier line setting than later line setting. Herceptin trials had 70% crossover, and we did not lose survival benefit, not close to it. So with certain very specific targeted drugs that target a specific mutation, it's conceivable that it works equally well for first line and late line patients. But by and large, you don't lose survival benefit completely. So if somebody shows me great PFS benefit, zero overall survival, I think there's something else going on.
Mark, you raise an important point, though. I was just thinking, by bringing up some other issues of how data it could be difficult to interpret. You mentioned crossover. You mentioned missing data. We mentioned data dredging.
Censoring, for example.
Censoring, data dredging.
Maybe you can just discuss censoring.
I'm going to say, in general, per protocol, there's a lot of ways that data is manipulated.
and not presented carefully. And very rarely when you see people assess companies and assets, do you really see them getting deep in any of these areas? Do you really see them question anything that the sponsor has laid out? There's a lot of nuance here. I mean, how often do you see, oh, I noticed something, there's 25% missing data here. What does that mean? You know, I don't see that. I don't see any, at a high level, I don't see anybody questioning anything. I just see them accepting the data and then, you know, moving forward and nodding their heads. So it's a key issue.
Let's take some questions. Brian?
Mark. So Rob and Mark and Kapil, I all thought you did great presentations, just great. So I wanted to ask you, Mark and Kapil, about this whole business of dose ranging and how you would do it. So just remember, and I think you, Kapil, you were there at the time, when Genentech Roche did bevacizumab, the whole business with colorectal, and they chose the 5 milligram dose based upon an N of 40 in each one. And then when you actually get into double or triple use, very often in these targeted therapies, you take the dose down anyway. So if you really want to do the dose ranging, what kind of size do you need to get a valid answer?
Well, you know, Brian, so I think it depends on, again, what you believe the dose response profile looks like. So if you believe that it's plateauing, then you're basically looking for evidence of a large difference. If you don't see a large difference, you're at or close to the plateau. And, you know, you've got pharmacokinetic variability anyway, and with oral drugs, it really can be quite profound. So I think it depends on the specifics, and I think this is where, you know, an adaptive dose-ranging trial design is useful. I think it depends what the phase one data look like, depends what the PK look like, what's the variability, what do you know about the drug as to how to optimally design it. But I think at the end of the day, you can do a trial that will get you pretty close to, you don't have to get it exactly right, but you want to be close enough that you know you're going to be, and it depends, of course, on what the toxicity issues are as well.
So just one thing to add, Brian. One of the things that I think in oncology we have underutilized, again, largely because of our training as the generation of oncologists we trained as, we don't think like non-oncology drug developers. If our drugs are truly getting better and we have more targeted drugs that are not genotoxic, that are not generally anti-proliferative, we probably can do more in healthy volunteer type of studies like the non-oncology folks to get some approximate idea of dose ranging and then decide how much dose ranging actually you need to do in large patient trials.
So just out of interest, you did show the fulvestrant stuff. So remember that fulvestrant is the only current agent that is effective in the ESR mutational population. So a lot of that 500 benefit may be just reflecting the benefit in that ESR1 mutational population where you need to give the higher dose.
Mike?
I'd like the panel's perspective on an approach, giving credit to everything you've said about how data is handled and followed up and scans are done, et cetera, is one of the approaches that I get a lot of when in my role as an analyst is companies, especially when it's novel mechanism of action, signal-seeking trials, usually in a relapse refractory patient population, is, oh, our drug produced an X-week duration of response versus that patient's prior duration of response, which was X minus some number. Can you comment?
I'll take that one. I mean, there's actually a pretty good statistical paper written by a former colleague of mine, Rosie Mick, that basically showed that analysis is totally flawed, that methodology is totally flawed. So I would basically, discount those data by 100%.
I guess the stocks are short.
By the way, Mike, I do. Mike's one of the good ones in the analyst group. I would encourage you to read his reports, and it's interesting that he's here today because he actually tries to understand data.
So. Yes, sir.
One of the challenges that we're facing is finding patients for studies with all those thousands or tens of thousands of studies that are going on. Earlier today, there was this idea of pulling together the control arms into a pool, which to me sounds like historical data because that's not part of your specific study. But when you were talking today, you were pretty negative on those historical data. So how do we, on one hand, pull together the control standard of care arms and yet rely on them?
Well, let me just say one thing on that, because I actually had tried to conjure up a thought on a data repository for all those small single-arm studies that is different from typical phase three or registry data historical controls. I mean, it's a little bit more flawed, but it'll actually show you much more variability and actually probably a much higher hurdle in order to overcome. So maybe we need to have the input of our data to be different than the typical large randomized studies and registry analyses.
Just to clarify my question, presumably 50% of the patients are wasted in the phase 3 studies, because most of the patients are in the phase 3 studies, not in the phase 2 studies. And we're all struggling to find centers and patients, and can we do something about it?
Well, you'd have to have, you know, if you have multiple investigational agents that either a single company or multiple companies are investigating and would be willing to partner on a trial where there's one control arm and multiple experimental arms, I think that's the concept. And then there's questions, how big should that control arm be and how do you do the actual randomization? That's a whole different issue. But I think one could have a common control arm within a single trial of multiple investigational options.
So actually, there's one specific example. I didn't have a chance to comment earlier when that point was raised. This is actually already being done. And the example is this Lung Master Protocol, which is a public-private partnership. So it's FNIH, NCI, various pharma companies, Lung Consortium, and the FDA is part of it. So, and it took about a year and a half, but through sheer willpower of FNIH guys, and it required your political muscle in D.C. to get acceptance from the FDA. But the idea is control arm was taxotere before PD-1 got approved. Now PD-1 is in the mix, and multiple experimental arms go in and out. So these are phase 2 studies, but the FDA has agreed. If in those phase 2 studies the experimental drug beats taxotere, they would consider approval. Obviously, there are many issues with respect to, heterogeneity of patients because of which can be dealt with. And in some ways, I-SPY trials also are on similar themes where you have a control arm and then you're bringing multiple investigational agents.
Question on the right? Yes.
Yeah, so thank you, by the way, clearly experienced clinicians discussing with a lot of experience. I'm curious, after the first phase one, you have 50 patients, you have your dose set, you're trying to decide what to do next. Either abandon the drug, go into it's obviously in refractory patients. What are the heuristics that you're looking at to make the decision for the next study, the phase two, in terms of what you're going to do? How do you look at the data that's obviously not going to be statistically significant? It's going to be all over the map. What are the things you're looking at typically for the next level?
Well, I think the first, I'll disagree with your first point. You have the dose set. You may know the up. You may know the upper bound on your dose. So I think it's one could conceivably make a decision to kill the drug. If one's not going to kill the drug, then one has to then think, okay, what am I going to do next? And I would go to some sort of dose ranging phase two trial and is my next step.
Tumor type, or are you looking at just trying to get more patients to get a signal, typically, if you don't see one right away? Or if you see a good signal, do you go for that? Or is it, basically any option is possible? Depends on the data.
My son, who's a lawyer, would say that's an incomplete hypothetical. and, I think it would the Lou. Devil would be in the details.
Lou?
Yeah, for Rob and Mark, my old mentor, the classical geneticist Ed Novitsky, argued, even in publications for years, that any publication reporting a p-value should also be required to disclose a lifetime p-value for the investigator. what do you think? I mean, I'm honest. I mean, he was a great statistician, and he advocated for it. I happen to agree with him. What do you guys think?
There's very few p-values that are presented that are truly a p-value, because the p-value should reflect what the a priori hypothesis is. And it's really, if you have the original protocol, you can figure it out.
Bob?
Rob, you appropriately talked about all the red flags that should go off when you see subgroup analyses or post hoc analyses in particular. Mm. But it's common now I see companies that just want to throw their drug into a trial, and then retrospectively they're going to look at the genotyping, RNA-seq, the signature of the drug. How can that be interpreted other than just saying, well, that's hypothesis generating? Would that ever show you a signature that would convince you that that drug deserves more investment and it's more likely to succeed than not?
I find that I've seen some MIT and mathematicians try to deal with that point, and I have no idea. I don't understand what they're doing. I think that is very hard. I think these, the gene arrays, and I think it's retrospective. It's so many basically queries all at one time that it makes absolutely no sense. You have to, the whole idea. I think retrospective data generating is okay if you have a very few queries. They should say how many they are. They can tell you if they want to do a gene array. They should just say, this is, we're testing to see if this is the case. This is what we would expect biologically, and then see. But when you start like saying, let's explore and see what we happen, and I'm running around, then it means absolutely nothing.
Rob, I'll give you the last word. You mentioned ascertainment bias. What are some of the other biases that intrude? Oh, I know you've got a long list, but maybe just some.
So ascertainment bias is obviously a very important one. Anytime you see open label, non-centralized review, you have to really be very – and there's, by the way, there's drugs getting approved like that, and I don't get it. Ascertainment bias means that the drug is itself able to unblind the trial.
Some of the other quick biases, right, that people should look for?
Obviously, big ones are selection bias. A big one is investigator biases, sponsor biases, wrong pop, lack of the wrong control being tested. Are they, that the wrong doses? I mean, there's a million different ones.
Time for one last question, or should we?
Well, back in here at 4:15, so you decide.
Okay. Someone's got it. I think we'll conclude. I want to thank the panelists. That was stimulating, and let's short those stocks.